Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm very pleased and privileged to be able to introduce Professor Danny Dorling, who will be speaking to us this afternoon on the subject of social and economic inequality, particularly in relation to the issue of schools and education. Danny Dorling is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at Oxford and is also a visiting professor of in the sociology department at Goldsmiths University of London. He has published widely in the area of social and economic inequality and will be speaking in the House of Commons next month. So without further delay, will you please welcome Professor Danny Dorling.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back here again. What I've got for you are a series of vaguely connected slides. I will stop on the hour to give you a chance to ask questions, and I'm going to show you a series of things about a range of issues that will get to education towards the end, but I'll just stop when we get on the hour. This, by the way, is a map of Europe. It's a map of Europe which is stretched so that each country is shown with its area in proportion to population, so you get an idea of where matters most. And this is an incredibly boring graph, but this graph is why your lives are going to be different to your parents, and possibly why your parents may not understand you in the next two decades. It's the change in average GDP per capita in the UK since just after the war. If you're my age, you would know about the 1970s recession because I was around in the 1970s recession and we thought it was a bad recession. I was a teenager in the 1980s recession. If you look very carefully, you can just about see the 1980s recession. And my friends, younger friends than me, complain that they couldn't get jobs in the 1990s recession. But you can hardly see those. Whereas what's happened since 2008 blows the rest of post-war economics out of the water. The country has become dramatically poorer, and the scope of the recession is deeper and bigger and longer than the 1929 recession. And if you're trying to understand things like why the referendum result went the way it did, in fact why we even had a referendum at all, that context, the 2008 financial crash, is very important. I'm starting off by saying this to you because to you this is just completely normal. This has been your teenage years. You have known nothing different to it and it doesn't feel that strange. But it is strange, and it's a context for everything we try to do, including what we may be able to do about education and schools, because we've become a poorer country. We're not just a poorer country than we used to be. We're also a very unusual country in Europe, which might explain why, apart from Greenland, we're the first that may leave the European Union. These are statistics from a whole complicated set of sources. It is incredibly tedious trying to collect these kind of things together. The column that really matters is the column in the middle, which is the share of income that the best off tenth of households take each year of all national income. And the thing you need to know, I think it's important for you to know this, is that the UK is extreme in Europe. The best off tenth of people take 28% of all income each year. This leaves far less for the other 90%. People in the top 10% do not feel that they're taking too much. I'm certainly in the top 10%, because the top 1% are actually taking half of all that. They take 14% of all income in the country. But people in the top 1% don't feel they're taking that much, because you can only just about afford a mortgage on a three-bed house in an affluent part of London if you're in the bottom half of the top 1%. And they look up above them and they see inequalities rise. And you can go all the way up to the Sunday Times rich list. Half of the best off families in the rich list are in London, but the best off 10 families have over a quarter of all the wealth of those 500. So if you're not in the best off 10, you can look up and say, but they're taking so much more than me. If you look down at the bottom, you'll find Slovenia, Norway, Denmark, Belgium, Finland, Austria, Sweden, It may not seem like a lot to you, going down to 20% rather than 28% of income. But 8% of national income is an awful lot of money. It funds you health services. It allows you to do things that you can't do in a country with the kinds of inequalities that we have. Let's skip that one. Let's go to this. This was a picture a friend of mine took in the Cotswolds a year ago. And we laughed about it. Because a year ago, we were fairly sure that the referendum was going to go for Remain. Touch and go, but that was the feeling of the establishment. It was the feeling of people who talked around high tables in Oxford colleges. It was the feeling in the BBC. It was the feeling amongst the majority of MPs. It was the feeling amongst pollsters. And that continued all the way up to the actual result. If you can remember the polls are saying it looked like a Remain majority. The spread betting, which for over two decades has tended to call these things correctly, said it was going to be Remain. And most of all, the money markets thought it was going to be Remain. And so the money began to move in the days before the actual poll towards thinking that Britain would remain. And then it didn't. Again, a map in which we've stretched space so that everybody gets an equal amount of space. If you look at things on the normal map, you get a very distorted view. There are two, so forget the normal map in the middle. The map far away from me is just showing which areas voted majority remain and which voted majority leave. And this was really interesting because it wasn't predicted and it produced a geography which we didn't expect. You'll know that London voted majority leave, places like Oxford did, but most of the south of England is actually blue. Some 60% of all leave voters in England lived in the south of England. 59% of them were social class A, B and C 1. People are still trying to work out who it was who voted how and why. This map here is shaded by the strength of the vote. And so the orange areas in the middle of London are where you're heading up towards 70% remain. Oxford is this little dot here, majority remain, surrounded by areas that were remain but only just, like the Cotswolds, surrounded by areas which were leave. You have a few areas on the east coast which were strongly leave, which had had relatively high changes in migration. The only way in which migration influenced the vote towards leave was if you'd suddenly had a large group of migrants arrive in an area. In general, places which had had many migrants for many years, such as London and Oxford, voted to stay. And of course the migrants didn't get a vote because you had to be a UK citizen or a Commonwealth citizen to get to vote. I'll get on to schools in a minute, but I thought I'd give you this context to give you ideas about questions you might want to ask. This is a map of Europe again. Again stretched so that you're looking at places where most people live. Just to show you the proportion of the population in each of those places that are born in another country. The UK doesn't have an unusual number of migrants. The migrants it does have, this is people born in another country living in the UK, are disproportionately concentrated in London or in Northern Ireland, which were the two regions along with Scotland that voted to remain. The area which is dark blue in the middle is Switzerland, which has the highest numbers of people for a large country born in other countries living there. And the other area you might notice is Spain. That circle down the bottom is Madrid in the middle of Spain. And there's high numbers of people from other countries in Spain, not least British people living in Spain. One other fact about the referendum I've been talking about recently is it was accompanied by a situation in which public sentiment about quality of life had been getting worse. These bar graphs are of an official statistic which is about people's satisfaction with their health. And if you could see the years, you'd see it's going 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13. Incredible changes in dissatisfaction with health. This measure was one of the components of the happiness index, which Prime Minister David Cameron announced around about 2010. and this part of the happiness index got much worse. But having announced a happiness index, and government's always doing this, nobody actually checked what was happening to it over time. Some civil servants were simply tasked with measuring it, but not recording it. The reason I'm putting up these graphs of self-reported health to you is that on referendum day, on the 23rd of June, the Office of National Statistics released the latest demographic figures for the country, which they always released around that time every year. And those figures showed that an extra 52,000 people had died in the year to June 2015, as opposed to the year to June a year earlier. That rise in mortality was the largest rise in mortality we've seen at any time since 1940. So couple of years after people said their health is getting worse, we got more people dying, mainly elderly people, dying a few years earlier than you'd expect. The deaths were mainly dementia and Alzheimer's. The news wasn't reported because it came out on the 23rd of June, and it was quite a busy news week and then a busy news month, and these things have still got to work their way through. Coming back to inequality and potential reasons for this. This data is from the IMF, and it's showing you for a series of countries the proportion of GDP that is raised in taxation and that is spent on public spending. The UK is a thick line, and you'll see a small increase in public spending 2002, 2003, 2004. That was the Labour government, and they were criticised for spending highly. But you'll see there's a whole series of countries which tax and spend more. Everywhere has an increase when the financial crisis occurred because of the spending necessary to stop the banks going bust. This has happened in your lifetime, and it is very, very relevant and very interesting to what we do next. People have sometimes complained, why did the government bail out the banks when they didn't bail out mines or shipyards in the 1980s? But mines and shipyards in the 1980s were almost at the end of their productive, profitable life. The banks in 2008 had never been more profitable. They employed only 4% of people, but produced 12% of our GDP. It was as if the coal mines in 1910 had suddenly discovered no more coal underground. That is the thing which has just happened. That's why they had to be bailed out. And the thick line going down, you'll see the actual cuts and the projected cuts till we get down to just spending 36% of our GDP on public services, like hospitals, like schools. Not like me. I now work in a largely privatised university. You'll be paying fees if you come to my university, and it'll pay my salary. But for our public services, we're down to 36%. And it's very different from other countries. There's often a danger of thinking that all countries are behaving in the same way or doing the same kind of thing, but the difference is huge. And if you're interested in schooling systems, the country which is always lauded as producing the children who do best is Finland. And I think this graph shows one of the reasons why Finland does well in its schools. It's partly how it organises its schools, but it's partly the amount of money it actually has for its schooling. One graph of immigration, just to show you, yes, of course it went up. This is all the way from 1841 to 2011. But what I'm not showing you here is a graph that looks very similar, which is emigration. Which is a bit higher in the past. We've actually sent out more people than have come in. But people are moving around the world now at a far greater rate than they did before. I want to get on to education very quickly. I've just got over 5 minutes. People blame the European Union for the state of things in the country. And the reason for showing you the differences between countries is to show you can be in the European Union and you don't have to be the way we've actually been. This was the aggregate effect of the last budget in terms of who benefited and who didn't benefit. Other countries do budgets in different ways. They were all in the EU. What's special about Britain is that we were incredibly rich. We were the centre of an empire And that makes us different from other countries and I think causes us problems. The pound's been in the news recently. When my grandfather was born, around about 1916, you could buy $5 for a pound. When my parents were born in the war, you could buy four. When I was born in the 1960s, you could buy three. When my first child was born, you could buy $2 for a pound. Give it a couple of years, there'll be one. It's an incredible change for a country. And it's partly because we've changed from being a place that made so much money out of places that we used to own. Finally, education. There is a link between inequality and education. Countries which are more economically unequal tend to produce worse educational results. These are PISA results for maths, and I'm showing you an inequality measure along the bottom. The United States is drawn large because it's got many people, and this is the average mark that children get in maths for a standardised international math test around about age 15. So just a year and a half younger than you. It's a bit vague, but there's a rough relationship. Here's the really interesting thing, and we get exactly the same thing for literacy and problem solving. Same kind of vague correlation. This is what happens if you test people at maths again a bit later, up to age 24. And imagine this being done for you, and this is quite hard to do. Almost all of you will be very, very good at maths. But you've been taught to be very good at maths. The question is, have you been taught maths in such a way that when you're age 24, if somebody were to give you a maths test, you would still do well at it, or not? And the argument here is that whatever they do in Japan and France and Germany, they're teaching mathematics and other subjects in such a way that it sticks in the heads of young people so that later on they can still do maths. Whereas what we do in this country is we train young people like you to get A stars, and in schools which are average we train people to get C's rather than D's, and it's all about the exam. Which is great for getting a good exam mark, but may not be good for actually learning a subject later in life. Schools. This is Oxford. I grew up in Oxford. It's where I work in Oxford. I suspect Oxford is the most educationally divided city in Europe. Because we have what are traditionally called very good schools, Magdalen College and Oxford Girls High and so on, and we have a series of state schools to which about two-thirds of the children in Oxford go, which are arranged geographically very simply from north to south, where at the south at the bottom we have what's now called the Academy School, which was Peer School, in which only about 28% of pupils get 5 A to C's. And then as you go up, the Catholic School, almost half, the Old Boys School, they all get renamed after time, 58%. The school I went to, 59%. Childwell Comprehensive, 72%. Between each of the catchment areas of these state schools, there is a £100,000 cliff in house prices. So you've got selection by house price going on. And what happens to people depends on the area they grow up in and the school they go to. And remember, they're entering a society in which you have these enormous differences in income. And so your future is being determined to an extent by these things, but not entirely by these things. There are various things you can do to address this, but saying that this is good enough, you probably can't do. Given how bad we do internationally, given how much people worry about it. So what could you do? You could create a grammar school. The grammar school, the county grammar school, used to be on the site of the school which now does worse. And the secondary modern used to be on the site of the school which does best, up in the north. We could create a grammar school again and send all the children who pass the 11 plus down there. But what would happen to the other children? And what would happen to the children who only just passed the 11 plus, but actually found things very hard in the grammar school? My suggestion, I'm talking to Oxford governors tomorrow night, is that we begin to think about how we can move teachers between the school sites, so that you don't have the situation now where the teachers are mostly under 25 in this school and last a year or two and then just go as fast as they can, and the only one of the schools where you'll find the majority of teachers over 30 is the school at the top. Need to begin to move teachers around the sites if you're not going to end up with inexperienced teachers teaching in the hardest school. And then you need to begin to move the pupils between the sites. And if you begin to move the pupils between the sites, there's no point in spending £300,000, £400,000 on a house in one area rather than another. And finally, and the question is, how do you get here? You need to try to get our schools to the level that schools are on most of the continent. Say in the city of Bonn, which is the shared twin city in Germany with Oxford, where people really don't worry too much about which school in Bonn their children go to. But for that, you have to get rid of geographical catchment areas, and you have to get pupils moving around. You can get pupils moving around as long as you do something about the roads, so they're not so deadly. And so it's connected to transport as well as education. We may move in that direction, we may not, but we're in an interesting situation because we have severe social problems. Move in that direction, make your state schools better, make them less segregated. And what then happens? And what then happens is that more parents would choose to use them, and then you could be in a better situation. I've painted you a bad picture, but I just want to end with an idea about why this is entirely possible. I went to this school, Cheyne, which is the average school in Oxford. And when I went, there were 300 of us in the year. There were about 200, 300 of you in a year. All that. And about half a dozen of us went to university. Today, that average state school in Oxford has a sixth form of 250, half the school. And most of them go to university, and most of them go to a Russell Group university. Leeds, Manchester, Exeter, that kind of university. Many of you are going to go to Leeds, Manchester, Exeter, and that kind of university. So if the world has changed since I was a child, to a world in which you can go to an average school in Oxford, even given all the problems we've got on the fact that only 59% of children get 5A to C's at GCSE. If the world has changed so much that your chances of your child is 10 times higher than it was for my cohort, there is a possibility of change and a possibility of movement. I'll end with that slide. There's the hierarchy of universities. Each of these dots is a university, drawn the size of the number of students at the university and coloured by a strange ratio, which is the research income divided by students. Now, in theory, the research income has nothing to do with students, but you can see the hierarchy. That's Cambridge, that's Oxford, you've got King's and UCL in London, Bristol's purple, Queen Mary there. None of the dots are coloured purple or red in the north. We're a country of educational division, extreme educational division in Europe. It's reflected through our schools, but then again reflected through our universities. But do these universities end up with people going on to jobs necessarily that are that much better than people from the other universities? What actually happens, we've got the data up to age 31, from the inland revenue linked to student loans, is that the vast majority of graduates from all these universities end up with pretty average paid graduate jobs, which are not that highly paid. In which case, is the hierarchy that beneficial? Is the idea of not going to your local university, which is what is normal in Scotland and in much of the USA and in much of the mainland of Europe, could we actually begin to move towards that? We have an education system, I'd argue, that's a relic of a past that is going to change, that's going to have to change with less money, a lot less money, and you're probably going to see that change happen over the next 10 or 20 years. And I wanted to give you an idea it is likely and why it's likely. And now I'm going to shut up and you're going to put your hands up and ask me a question about anything I've shown or any of the attitudes I've expressed. Who's brave? Yep.
You talked a lot about the need to reduce inequality, and I'm curious why you think inequality is more important than improving the overall objective quality of education.
If you have a possibility, so the possibility is, could you have a country in which the outcomes for young people were very different, but on average they all did much better than other children in another country? The reason I don't worry about that possibility is that it doesn't exist anywhere. Whereas we have an example of a whole series of countries where the overall average is much higher, but also the ability of those at the top is better than us. So it's theoretically possible that you could get what you want, but it just hasn't happened. An example of ability at the top being higher is that when we hire lecturers and researchers, we are disproportionately hiring people from mainland Europe to do our research jobs because they can program computers, they can use maths in imaginative ways, they have learnt better. We tend not to hire British people for jobs in educational research in Britain or pharmaceuticals and so on because they're just not as good. And this, it sounds disrespectful and unpatriotic, but when you begin to see the ratios of people who are employed from various EU countries, which we're now beginning to produce because we're worrying about what on earth are we going to do if we can't employ them, you begin to worry that we do have a problem, and it's not simply about the bottom of our education system. It's a total. British universities will not let PISA examine their pupils. So Oxford will not allow a set of inspectors to come in from Europe and give some standard tests to our 21-year-olds. Because we want to say our 21-year-olds are incredibly clever. But also because we're slightly worried what would happen if you did compare our 21-year-olds to 21-year-olds in Paris or in Berlin. So the argument is, we've seen that countries that worry about equality tend to do better for education. The OECD produces educational statistics where they've said that high educational divisions damage overall. Another way, I promise any more answers, I'll keep short. Another way to try to understand it is a bit unfair, but think about caricatures of Americans. Think about Americans. George Bush went to Yale and Harvard, I think, or was it Princeton and Harvard? Anyway, George W. Bush. And Americans tell you how able they are and how clever they are and what amazing GPA scores they've got and so on. There's a high degree of self-belief in the United States of America. But when you come to test people's actual abilities, it's not as good as people who've come from a society in which they weren't divided so much at such an early age. Another question? Back?
You mentioned there was a culture of preparing for the exam rather than learning the subject in the UK. How would you combat this?
Okay. The problem is, it's got so bad that we've confused being good at something with getting an A. We think it's exactly the same thing. Whereas what we've become really brilliant at is exam technique. Right, we've produced cohorts of young people who are very, very, very good at taking exams. The problem is that there isn't a crying need to have 24, 34, 44-year-olds who are good at taking exams. There is a crying need for people who can be imaginative, who can... The person who created that map was born in Switzerland and grew up in Germany. I can't get a researcher who knows how to create that map using a computer. So it's imagination. I would combat it by reducing the amount of examinations we take. So look at the Finnish system, where you do not have national examinations, you do not produce league tables between schools. I think it's about time we can get rid of a formal examination at age 16. On that map of Oxford, I showed you that Magdalen College doesn't have it because they don't take GCSEs. I suspect you don't take GCSEs, I haven't asked.
They do.
They do, okay. But imagine this, I know you've just taken them and you've got lots of A stars and A's, but imagine if you didn't have GCSEs. Other European countries do not have an exam at 16 anymore, which is so important. So I would reduce that. Just reduce the number of examinations we do. And also not narrow the curriculum as we're doing, so that you do so few things. Because if you come and study geography and you want to be a really good geographer, you need to know about history and biology and mathematics and a bit of chemistry. So the wider education you've had earlier on, the better it is for being able to do research on climate change or energy sources or whatever in future. Question there?
This may sound institutionally arrogant, but given the picture that you painted, what can the boys in this hall, or even what can this school do about it?
I think the main thing is trying to get beyond being proud of very high marks. You have to get very high marks, that is a necessity. But if you begin to see getting very high marks as something you have to do but not the be-all and end-all, then you can relax slightly about the number of A's and A stars and the occasional B. My institution also needs to do this. My institution hates B's. You can relax slightly about the marks and slightly widen the curriculum and experiences in that place. Because the world is about to change so much, because you're entering such a different world from generations before you. People often, there's a common question that came up on the BBC a couple of weeks ago, why are so many prime ministers from Oxford? And the easy answer is because there were hardly any other universities in the past. And as soon as you look at the expansion of universities and how many people are going, you see you're going to enter a different world. So slightly ramping down the importance of the exams and slightly ramping up the idea of a wider set of interests in different things. And also I would say, and it probably may be the wrong thing to say, but I'll say it, don't be too obsessed by Oxford and Cambridge. They're interesting places, I teach there, I like it. But in a way, partly from being at this school, you've had half the experience of what you get at Oxford and Cambridge anyway. You've had very good teaching, but you've also had formality and all of that. So if you are thinking of going to other universities, and I suspect the majority of you will go to another university, think of how much going to another university will actually widen your horizons compared to going to a university like mine, which where the buildings look rather like these buildings and so on. And an acceptance of a wider set of outcomes as being good could be a way of changing. Just behind you.
Would abolishing public schools...
Shout out louder.
Would abolishing public schools, such as this one, which you might say they do cause a social and educational divide, would that be a good way to sort of remedy in our education system in this country? Would that be
A lot of people of my political disposition, most of my friends are in favour of abolishing public schools. I'm not. I'm unusual. I'm even in favour of keeping charitable status. Because without charitable status, you would have the full... You'd open up what I call the gates of hell of the profit motive, and it would be horrible. My theory about what we should do is improve state education to a point where it became tricky to run as many independent schools as we do, and they would have to be better, good, interesting alternative to survive. This school is going to still be here in 200-400 years time, probably. I suspect there'll be young women in it as well. Magdalen College, which is actually the university-sponsored school. You know, the government wants us to sponsor schools to help them and doesn't quite realise we already do sponsor one. It just does rather well. Modern College now takes girls. So this school will change in the next century or so, but it'll still exist. But my preference is to get a situation in which our schools are of the standard that they are in Europe, where you don't think, I have to send my child to school which will cost more, because otherwise if they don't do well at school they will end up in a very poor job and be very poorly paid. In Switzerland, the 1% take half as much as our 1%. People working at the top of finance are paid half as much. The Swiss banks still work, and a cleaner in Switzerland is paid three times as much as a cleaner here, so that the society is much more cohesive. In Bonn, it took me some time to get a school teacher in Bonn to rank the schools of Bonn. And the schools are almost all state schools in Bonn. There's only one other country in the OECD that spends more on private education than us, and that's Chile. We spend 30% of all the money we spend on secondary education on just 7% of pupils. And that is extremely unusual. We're also spending that money on the people who, in general, are doing fairly well at education. You have to pass entrance exams. Would you set up a hospital or health service where you spent the bulk of your money on the people who are already most healthy? Or would you spend it on people who had worse health? In other European countries and in Japan, they actually put more resources into people who are behind at school.
It's fascinating to see, laid out in hard statistics and very clear graphs, some of the profound social and economic changes this country's gone through since the war, and indeed daunting to think that there may be large-scale social and economic change on the horizon within our immediate lifetimes. Could you please join me in thanking Professor Dorling?